Welcome to History Sleepcast, history books to fall asleep to. Thank you for joining me tonight on this relaxing journey through history. In today's Sleepcast, we'll be diving into the pages of Charles I by Sir John Skelton, published in 1898 by Goupil & Co. So, find a comfortable spot, take a deep breath, and we'll begin our book. Chapter 1. The English Constitution under the Tudors. When Henry Richmond on the field of Bosworth assumed the crown, the Catholic Church was still powerful in England, and the new learning had made comparatively little progress. The life, both civic and religious, was still ruled by a code, which had been framed in the Middle Ages. The genius of a medieval architect had made our cities picturesque, and the ceremonies of medieval Catholicism splendidly decorative, lent the colour that might be needed. What a spectacle to the rustic coming from outlying marsh or woodland, and in those days, a third of the land at least was marsh and woodland, must a cathedral city have presented. We may compare the August ritual of Rome unfavourably with a simpler service, but only the narrowest fanaticism can treat it with ridicule. In that communion, there were then as now, let Puritanism say what it may, many pure and spiritually minded men, who were able to rise above the allurements of sense and to behold, beyond the smoke of the incense and the gloom of the sanctuary, the vision of a righteous judge. Nor was it in the cathedral city alone that the church wielded an unquestioned authority. With uncompromising energy, it had penetrated into fen and forest. It shared the most absolute solitudes with the wild animals of the chase. Centuries had passed since Canute and his kings, lying on their oars, had listened to the evensong of the monks of Ely, and men who shrank from the rough issues of common life still practiced, upon the marsh of Romney or among the Lincoln washes, the perilous virtues of a cloister. Yet it was true that somehow or other, the whole of the spacious edifice had been undermined, and that it was tottering to its fall. Mitred ecclesiastics in the privacy of the chapter house might still discuss the policy of princes without any sense of impending doom. The faith once delivered to the saints was still expounded in remote hamlet or crowded city by faithful servants of the Most High. But behind the fair show there was, it cannot be doubted, foul decay. The written record remains. Too often the monastic building has become a den of thieves, too often the nun, the bride of heaven, is as shameless as the monk. Pilgrims swarming with vermin swarm along the highways. Filthy mendicants recount their filthy adventures at this or the other shrine. Pardoners dispose of their stale wares cheaply to gaping rustics. The popular satirist must not be taken too literally, and we are not bound to believe that the French hood and bonne grace of the Virgin, the great toe of the Trinity, the jawbone of all saints, and the bees that stung Eve when she ate the apple were hawked about, yet only a few years later, when the visitation of the monasteries was proceeding. Leighton wrote to Cromwell from the priory of Maiden Bradley, "By my servant I send you relics. First, two flowers wrapped in white and black sarcenet, but one Christmas even, horror ipse qua Christus natus fuerit, will spring and burgeon and bear blossoms. Quod expertum esse, saith the prior of Maiden Bradley, ye shall also receive a bag of relics, wherein ye shall see strange things, as shall appear by the scripture. As Our Lady smoke, part of God's supper, in sine domini pars petra super, qua natus erat Jesus in Bethlehem. Belike there is in Bethlehem plenty of stones, and maketh their mangiers of stone. The scripture of everything shall declare you all, and all this of Maiden Bradley, whereas is an holy prior, and have but six children, and but one daughter married, yet of the goods of the monastery, trusting shortly to marry the rest. I send you also Our Lady's girdle of Bruton, red silk, which is a solemn relic sent to women travelling, which shall not miscarry in partu." The scandal was open, it was noised abroad, it became the subject of common jest and satire, when lines like Heywood's, lines penned, be it observed, by a devout Catholic, "With small cost and without any pain, these pardons bring them to heaven plain. Give me but a penny or two pence, and as soon as the soul departeth hence, in half an hour, or three quarters at most, the soul is in heaven with the Holy Ghost." When lines like these could be listened to, not only without protest, but with keenest relish by a Catholic audience, the end could not be far off. The change indeed from one extreme to the other came with startling rapidity. Within 100 years of Henry's death, one half of England was Puritan. Whatever precautions might be taken, A vast spiritual confederacy, thoroughly organised, could not but be a menace to liberty. It was easier, on the other hand, to protect the life and property of a subject against an arbitrary exercise of a prerogative of a crown, and on paper, it may be, ample guarantees had been given. The Great Charter itself was only one of a series of measures designed to preserve the freedom of the English commonalty. Where the spirit of a free people is absent, legislation is well nigh worthless. Either by fraud or force, it can be invaded by an unscrupulous ruler. Against the tyranny of prince and priest, the Englishman was protected less by legislation than by his own sturdy independence of character and the action of his municipal system, excepting the greater nobles, who during the dynastic wars had been nearly exterminated. The gentry were mostly resident on their estates. Some of them occasionally proceeded to Westminster for the transaction of parliamentary business, but the hardship of being sent there was so great, although the burgesses at least had been paid for their attendance, that the crown had frequently to compel the shires and burghs to elect representatives. Impassable roads infested by highwaymen, wretched hostels infested with vermin, made it a matter of labour and peril to reach the metropolis from a distant county. Thus, each district of the kingdom continued to preserve within itself the elements of an independent and vigorous society. The gentry were the natural leaders of a pastoral people, with whom, on their many national and religious festivals, they familiarly mingled. To the classes engaged in commerce, the local guilds and the great trading societies supplied an obvious basis of cooperation and defence. A system which concentrates in the capital the whole machinery of government is apt to weaken and enervate the national life. And though it is true that the bylaws of the county courts and of the borough magistrates were conceived in a peculiarly hostile and narrow spirit, yet it was fortunate for England that the discharge of civic duties and the exercise of local government had made the English layman, the yeoman as well as the gentleman, tenacious of his rights and jealous of his liberties. There were two constitutional questions that came to the front in the prolonged and bitter quarrel between the Stuarts and their parliaments. 1. What was the compact between the houses and the sovereign as to the revenues of the crown, the revenues by which the royal state was to be maintained? 2. Had there been any illegal exercise of the royal prerogative, A. as regarded taxation, B. as regarded the liberty of the subject, C. as regarded religion? It is in the settlement of those questions that the practice of the Tudors is instructive. There is a further question of how far the Tudors themselves were responsible for the conditions, social, political, ecclesiastical, which made the quarrel inevitable. The resistance to Charles in Parliament and in the country was conducted mainly by the Puritans, but for the harsh and oppressive laws of Elizabeth, there would have been, so far as we can judge, few, if any, Puritans. For the Puritan, therefore, Elizabeth must be held responsible. No doubt other forces than religion were at work. How far these contributed to make the crisis acute, we shall see hereafter. But it may be said generally that they were all due, more or less directly, to the spirit of unrest which the Reformation, the new learning, the discovery of other worlds in the heaven above and on the earth beneath, had provoked. The temper of the time was revolutionary, and Charles was its first victim. Between revolution and the reaction from revolution, excess on either side is probably inevitable. If democratic theories of government had not been in the air, less would have been heard of the divine right of kings. On a casual survey, one may have been inclined to conclude that during the Tudor regime at any rate, the monarch was sufficiently absolute. Except on rare occasions when popular indignation was keenly roused, any control exercised by the Parliament was nominal. There may have been in theory constitutional limitations, in practice it was personal rule. The very names of the parliamentary leaders have been forgotten, whereas the personality of Henry VIII or of Elizabeth is stamped indelibly upon the national record. They had great ministers, Wolsey, Cromwell, Cecil, but none of these statesmen derived his force from Parliament or owed his elevation to eminence in parliamentary council or debate. Yet, the historians who have argued that the exercise of the kingly authority was subject to restraints, sanctioned by ancient statutes and immemorial usage, which even the most arbitrary and autocratic of the Tudors did not care to disregard, are not without warrant for their view. Mr. Hallam has observed that at the accession of the Tudors, the essential checks upon the royal authority were five in number. 1. The king could levy no sort of new tax upon his people, except by the grant of a parliament consisting as well of bishops and mitred abbots or lords spiritual, and of hereditary peers or temporal lords, who sat and voted promiscuously in the same chamber, as of representatives from the freeholders of each county, and from the burgesses of many towns and less considerable places, forming the lower or Commons House. 2. The previous assent and authority of the same assembly was necessary for every new law, whether of a general or temporary nature. 3. No man could be committed to prison but by a legal warrant specifying his offence, and by a usage nearly tantamount to constitutional right, he must be speedily brought to trial by means of regular sessions of jail delivery. 4. The fact of guilt or innocence on a criminal charge was determined in a public court, and in the county where the offence was alleged to have occurred, by a jury of 12 men, from whose unanimous verdict no appeal could be made. Civil rights, so far as they depended on questions of fact, were subject to the same decision. 5. The officers and servants of the Crown, violating the personal liberty or other right of the subject, might be sued in an action for damages to be assessed by a jury, or in some cases were liable to criminal process, nor could they plead any warrant or command in their justification, nor even the direct order of the King. If indeed these checks existed, and no doubt they did on paper, it can hardly be denied, I think, except possibly by the legal pedant, but up to the close of Elizabeth's reign, they had been habitually evaded. Parliaments of the Tudors were in one sense servile. The great ecclesiastical reforms that were being carried through during years of peril and despondency required undivided counsel, and so long as the national credit was maintained, both peers and commons were content to acquiesce. The Crown had no doubt many creatures of its own in either house. Arbitrary measures were taken to secure a loyal representation, but unless the people had been fairly satisfied that monarch and minister might be trusted to do their best for England, there would have been petitions and protests. One cannot help feeling that in such servility, there was a touch of patriotism which later parliaments might have imitated with advantage. Yet even these servile parliaments were often dispensed with. Years would pass before their attendance was required at Westminster. Elizabeth was penurious by nature, and though Henry VIII was recklessly profuse, the savings of his father and the spoils of the monasteries were immense. It is true that most of the church lands went to greedy nobles and obsequious courtiers, but we may assume, as has been assumed by our constitutional writers, that in the interest of the Reformation, this was a politic in Providence, seeing that the persons among whom the partition was made would, in accordance with the general laws of human nature, give a readier reception to truths which made their estates more secure. Thus, it came about that during many years, the ordinary expenditure did not exceed the ordinary revenue of the Crown. A grant of tonnage and poundage, and of the first fruits of benefices, was made for life to the sovereign on his accession, and this could be supplemented on occasion by the voluntary assessments known as benevolences. The legality of these assessments has been, and continues to be, disputed, but they were sanctioned at least by inveterate custom, so that it was only in an exceptional crisis, as when a costly war was imminent, that the houses were summoned to impose a compulsory tax. It would be exaggeration to assert that the judges of the High Courts of Justice were corrupt, but there can be little doubt that many of them were partial to the authority by whom they were appointed, and by whom they could be dismissed. Neither the goods nor the life of any man who ventured to entertain sentiments unacceptable at court was secure. Between heresy and treason, the line was loosely drawn, and what was heresy today was truth tomorrow. On one hurdle, 6 malefactors were sent by Henry to the stake. 3 had denied the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation. 3 had refused to take the Anglican oath of supremacy. The whim of the moment was the standard of right and wrong, and to that whim, the most tremendous penalties were attached. The courts of law might on occasion be unduly complacent to the Crown, but when hard pressed, they could assert their independence. There was another tribunal, however, which, as its admirers declared, was not disabled by legal scruples or troubled by legal subtleties. Short of life and death, the jurisdiction of the Star Chamber was absolute, and the members of the Star Chamber were the counsellors of the Crown. Torture was repugnant to English notions of fair play and honest inquiry. In the Star Chamber, it was freely employed. The House of Peers was another court of criminal jurisdiction where the will of the sovereign was paramount. Either by impeachment or act of attainder, many of the most powerful nobles, Warwick, Suffolk, Buckingham, had been brought to the block. The Bill of Attainder was a mendacious device by which both houses were made accessory to Henry's judicial murders. It was an instrument of gross injustice and oppression, a suspension of legal process by an act of the legislature. The judges who had been consulted by Cromwell had declared that, although no evidence had been led, no court of law could reverse an attainder, and Cromwell himself was sentenced unheard. Whether reached by impeachment or attainder, however, the goal was the same. One cannot but wonder how it should have come about, that a house of powerful and independent nobles should have been so easily satisfied of the guilt of so many of their order, especially when each new conviction added to the common peril. While it may be true that the previous authority of Parliament was necessary for every new law, it does not appear to have been invariably obtained. Royal proclamations were frequently issued by which important constitutional changes were effected. Though the assent of the legislature was subsequently accorded, it was by proclamation that the great ecclesiastical reform was initiated. For an acute emergency, it is indispensable that some discretionary power should be vested in the crown. What a king by his royal power may do, to use Henry's words, has never been precisely determined. Even democratic governments are sometimes forced to break the law and trust to act of indemnity. What may be called the reserved and latent energy of the crown, to be exerted only when the state is in extreme peril, received under the Tudors very liberal application. The Anglican Church is finally established under Elizabeth at the Nag's Head Tavern, as the Catholic satirists affirmed, was a compromise. It stood midway between Rome and Geneva. The Queen herself regarded either extreme with impartial dislike. She would tolerate within her kingdom neither Papist nor Puritan. It is probable that, of the two, Puritanism was the most distasteful to her. She scoffed at Cecil and his brothers in Christ, yet Cecil's Puritanism was comparatively colourless and courtly. But her animosity to Puritanism could not be fully gratified. In all her parliaments, the House of Commons, which was ceasing to be servile, was vehemently Protestant. So were her most trusted ministers. The early Puritans were loyal to the monarchy, obstinately loyal to Elizabeth herself. On the other hand, pretexts for Catholic persecution were easily found. Those of them who refused to take the oath of supremacy were punished, not because they were heretics, but because they were traitors, as no doubt many of them were, though with the majority the treason was constructive only. During the whole of Elizabeth's reign, the laws against recusants were severe, but as the shadows lengthened, the gloom deepened. One would have fancied that after the Armada had been dispersed, there might have been a respite. Her rival queen was dead. Mary Stuart's detention in England had been, as Hallam admits, in violation of all natural public and municipal law, and her trial was a travesty of justice. But the rivalry for an earthly crown at least was over. And during the months of breathless suspense when the island queen was standing at bay, the Catholics had behaved well. But the government was merciless. The rack in the tower was seldom idle. During these last years, no less than 200 Catholics were quartered while yet alive. Butchery was justified by Bacon on the ground that bowling was less painful than burning or the wheel. Hardly a protest against this cruel slaughter was heard. Lord Burghley, indeed, who was not always consistent, however, had at length, in an emphatic minute which has been preserved, ventured to remonstrate, "I account that putting to death does no way lessen them, since we find by experience that it worketh no such effect, but, like Hydra's heads, upon cutting off one, seven grow up." Persecution being accounted as the badge of the church, and therefore they should never have the honour to take any pretence of martyrdom in England, where the fullness of blood and greatness of heart is such that they will, even for shameful things, go bravely to death. Much more, he adds, when they think thus to climb to heaven, and their obstinacy commands them to the common people who regard it as a divine constancy. Nor should it be forgotten that, when the harsh act of 1562 was passing through Parliament, Lord Montague had preferred an earnest plea for liberty of conscience, if not for liberty of speech. He entreated peers to consider whether it was just by penal statute to force loyal subjects of the realm to believe the religion of Protestants on pain of death. This I say to be a thing most unjust, for that it is repugnant to the natural liberty of men's understanding. For understanding may be persuaded, but not forced. Only a man of no courage or stomach, and void of all sense of honour, would consent to receive a new religion by compulsion, or swear the contrary of what he thinks. Even a brave man might consent to be silent, to keep his reckoning with God alone. But to be compelled to swear to a lie, or else to die if he refused, was a thing that no man ought to suffer and endure. A fine speech for any assembly, considering the time when it was made, and the passions that were abroad, a really noble and memorable appeal. If a Catholic was treated with merciless severity, the Puritan did not entirely escape. It is a popular superstition that persecution must fail. It does not fail when it is carried out with inflexible decision. It fails only when the Inquisitor is timid and irresolute. The Puritans, who were merely ejected from their livings or driven from their conventicles, rapidly increased in number, so that before the close of Elizabeth's reign, A body of bitter sectaries had become formidable, a force to be reckoned with in the political world. The Catholics, on the other hand, who had been pursued with unsparing vigour, had dwindled to a handful. Those who write history are presumably more sagacious than those who make it. We are wise after the event. To us, the folly of Elizabeth and her ministers in their treatment of nonconformity is painfully obvious. And indeed, there is good reason to believe that a little forbearance at the outset might have healed the feud. Nonconformity was in effect a protest against the act of supremacy and the act of uniformity. But the language of protest in the earlier years was mild. It would have been difficult, no doubt, at any time to have conciliated the more violent spirits who had listened while in exile to Knox or Calvin, but if a certain latitude had been admitted, if liberty of private judgment on trifles had been conceded, if reasonable elasticity instead of rigid uniformity had been the policy of Parker and Whitgift, it is possible that the discontent might have been allayed, might have died out. Then, as now, men of sense must have regarded the frivolous uses to which either party attached undue importance, the retention of a crucifix or a taper, of a tippet or surplice, the sign of a cross in baptism, the ring in matrimony, the posture at communion with indifference. It was wise, perhaps, when half the people were still Catholic at heart, to retain some of the ceremonies to which they had been used. The transition was more easily effected when friction was reduced to a minimum, but when it had become obvious that uniformity would occasion lasting discord, that a party, so Parsons wrote of 1594, more vigorous than any other, most ardent, quick, bold, resolute, and having a great part of the best captains and soldiers on their side, would resist to the uttermost, a sagacious statesman would have loosened the bonds. Nor to such a minister would the royal supremacy have proved an insuperable barrier. The oath might have been modified by politic reservations, which would have saved the scruples of the precise. The Puritans might be, as Cecil thought, over squeamish and nice in their opinions, and more scrupulous than they need. Yet, by their careful catechizing and diligent preaching, they were doing service to the state, which ought rather to approve than condemn. But it was not to be. History was to take a different course. Elizabeth was to leave the Puritan as a legacy to her successor. Even before her death, he had become very truculent, a byword for rudeness, asperity, and intractability. The High Commission, an ecclesiastical court armed with the powers of an Inquisition, could not silence Martin Marprelate. The Brownists grew the more they were repressed, and as invariably happens, there was a rapid development of doctrine. The demands of the earlier dissenters were comparatively moderate. To episcopal government in the church, to personal rule in the state, they did not seriously object. But foolish intolerance had borne its usual fruit. Episcopacy had become hateful to them. Presbytery was not only lawful, but divinely ordained. A government based on popular consent was the true form of civil rule. The claim for ecclesiastical independence, or rather for spiritual supremacy, was insistently preferred, by Thomas Cartwright at least, in language that might have been coined by Hildebrand. The civil magistrates were the nurses, but they were also the servants of the church. And as they rule in the church, so they must remember to submit themselves unto the church, to submit their sceptres, to throw down their crowns before the church, yea, as the prophet speaketh, to lick the dust off the feet of the church. It is to be noted, moreover, that in the later years of Elizabeth's reign, the commons, largely reinforced from the ranks of the Puritans, clung to their ancient privileges with increasing tenacity and were readier to assert their independence. The arbitrary exercise of the prerogative was still common. The Star Chamber continued to sit and to inflict penalties on obstinate or contumacious jurymen. Proclamations continued to be issued. The printing of books was subjected to severe restrictions. The too rapid increase of the metropolis was held to be a public danger and forbidden. Once at least, martial law had been proclaimed. But though the members of the Commons themselves were occasionally committed to the Tower for imprudent or insolent speech, arbitrary encroachments on their customary privileges were, in each successive Parliament, more keenly resented and more strenuously resisted. These privileges were numerous. The claim for liberty of speech and access to a royal person was preferred at the opening of each session. They were the guardians of their own order. Then the members were exempted from arrest on civil process while the House sat. They held, moreover, that they were entitled to inquire into every grievance and to find the appropriate remedy. Before the close of the century, they had attacked the subsidies demanded and the monopolies granted by the Crown. Elizabeth, in her most formidable and autocratic mood, failed to overawe them. The Wentworths and their fellows were not to be silenced. Morris, from his room in the tower, assured Lord Burghley that he would continue to strive, while life lasted, for freedom of conscience, public justice, and the liberties of his country. They were warned that idle heads should not meddle with reforming the church and transforming the Commonwealth, but they replied that to utter any griefs of the Commonwealth was theirs of right. The attack on the monopolies granted by the sovereign to impecunious courtiers was a bitter pill for Elizabeth to stomach. The prerogative, she declared, was the choicest flower in her garden, and the principal and head pearl in her crown and diadem. But the clamour grew so loud that she was forced to give way, and with that politic or feline adroitness which she could practice on occasion, to compliment the commons on their solicitude for the public well-being. On every side, the waters were rising. There was a pause while Elizabeth lay on her deathbed. But the storm had not spent itself. It was clear that the finest tact and the surest judgment would be needed to steer the state bark into a peaceful haven. How far the Stuarts on whom the command now devolved would prove fit for the duty remained to be seen. Chapter 2. The Scottish Stuarts. The compilers of pedigrees are mainly responsible for the earlier records of the Stuarts. What they have to tell us when they leave the region of conjecture admitting of rapid summary. The Scottish House of Stuart was descended from the English House of FitzAlan, whose arms they bore, but, in allusion, it is said to their hereditary office, with the fess checkey on the shield slung round the neck of a mounted knight. They were Scottish nobles for several generations before they became Scottish kings. Many cadets of noble Norman houses came to Scotland when David I was on the throne, and were cordially welcomed by him. Among them were two of the FitzAlans, two brothers, Walter and Simon. Walter, for some reason which does not clearly appear, speedily obtained high preferment. The Steward of Scotland, otherwise the Seneschal or Dapifer, was a powerful functionary, perhaps the most powerful among the great officers of state. The office was hereditary. Conferred on Walter, son succeeded father in unbroken order until it came to be held by that other Walter who was with Bruce at Bannockburn. He was then quite a youth, but he had already won a name by his gallant bearing and his winning manners. A few months after the great battle, he was sent to the border to receive the Scots prisoners who had been detained in England, among them Elizabeth the wife and Marjorie the daughter of King Robert. His wooing must have been done while they rode from Carlisle to Edinburgh or Stirling, for early in 1315 he was married to Marjorie. Next year a boy was born, but the mother died. The steward was acting as regent at the time, the king being in Ireland. In 1318 he defended Berwick very gallantly against the great English army, and in 1322 he nearly surprised the English king at Billund Abbey in Yorkshire, but for a hard ride to York, Edward would have been captured. He had had a brief, brilliant, adventurous career when in 1326 he was struck down by mortal illness. He died in his 33rd year. Had he lived, he might have equalled Randolph and Douglas, but his course of glory was short. The boy who was born in 1316 was the grandson of the victor of Bannockburn. He too was a Robert, and for 30 distracted years, only the unhappy David stood between him and the throne. David, who had no love for the valiant steward, did his best to divert the succession. But David left no son by Margaret Logie. The Scottish people would on no condition accept the English Lionel, so that on David's death, the steward's claim to the throne, under the settlement of 1318, was conceded without serious debate. It was then, however, that the rivalry of the great House of Douglas, pregnant with so many disasters to Scotland, first made itself felt, a rivalry which a politic marriage pacified for the moment. Robert II was succeeded by his son, another Robert. Robert III, in spite of mental and physical infirmities, had many of the attractive traits of his family, but for some time before his death, the reins of government had dropped from his hands. His younger brother, the Earl of Fife, who latterly became the famous or infamous Duke of Albany, was the real governor. Whether Albany was responsible for the death of his nephew Rothesay at Falkland is a matter of controversy. That he was responsible for the prolonged detention of James in England is not open to doubt. It need not therefore occasion any surprise that James should have regarded Albany and all his race with peculiar bitterness, and that the atonement which he exacted should have been stern and terrible. Albany is one of those peculiar and powerful characters which perplex the historian. He had great opportunities which he misused. Under his government, during a period of profound peace, Scotland was given over to anarchy. The patrimony of the crown, the estates of the church, were squandered among nobles who were little better than brigands. On the other hand, he had strong natural affections. He was a devoted father. When he sinned for his children. He appears besides to have had tastes and occupations which were uncommon in that rude society. He was a man of letters, a man of science. The contemporary annalists are his apologists. The crafty and rapacious tyrant is regarded by Bower and Winton and Barber with genuine enthusiasm. Amid the turbulence of border warfare, he is represented as engaged in archaeological pursuits, recovering and restoring the relics of an earlier age. A still more striking scene has been preserved by Bower. Sitting on the ramparts of the Castle of Edinburgh, the regent discourses to his courtiers during the moonlight night of the causes of eclipses and the order of the universe. With the return of James, my sketch's consecutive narrative may close. The lights and shades in the lives of the later Stuarts are familiar to us all. I turn to the question that mainly concerns us, how far their Scottish experience had fitted them for English rule. The precise relation of these Scottish sovereigns to their people, their parliaments, and the great feudal nobles falls to be considered. The Stuarts indeed had little reason to dread either the parliament or the people. The parliaments, through the lords of the articles, were easily managed, and the commons were proud of a family who were associated with a patriotic tradition and worthily represented King Robert. But the conflict with the aristocratic leaders was long and bitter. Feudalism died hard. Mar and March and Douglas for many a year were as powerful as the sovereign, and in Scotland a divided rule meant anarchy. Thus, it became a settled policy of the Stuarts to strengthen the authority of the crown by reducing the power of the aristocracy. While a score of petty potentates continued to exercise an independent jurisdiction, anything like an orderly government was impossible. It cannot be truly said that the Stuarts were worsted in the contest. They did much. Under happier circumstances, they might have done more, but the stars in their courses fought against them. 1. There was always England to reckon with. The Scots kings had to be constantly prepared for invasion. A nation far more powerful in numbers and wealth lay on their flank. But the fighting force of the country consisted mainly of the feudal retainers of the great nobles, and when the great nobles were gravely displeased, they refused to fight. Had they been cordially united, they might have formed a league which would have left king and kingdom defenceless. The utmost tact and dexterity were needed to avert a disaster which, once at least, occurred, and which more than once was imminent. 2. The Stuarts were never wealthy, and impoverished rulers are forced to husband their resources. In his anxiety to secure for himself and his family the support of the peers, the ancient revenues of the crown had been squandered by Albany, and when James returned from his English exile, he found an empty exchequer. Later on, when the abbey and other ecclesiastical lands were in the market, the sovereign was abroad, and the patronymy of the crown was greedily appropriated by hungry nobles. The League of the Peers against Mary is to be ascribed, I believe, to their apprehension that she might revoke the generous grants which they had made to each other in her absence. There can be little doubt, it may be added, that Maitland of Levington cordially approved the Stuart policy. No government, he held, could be responsible for public order so long as vast territories were under the absolute rule of a Hamilton or a Gordon. 3. It was difficult to maintain a firm and consistent policy of repression when the sovereign was a minor, and long minorities were the curse of Scotland. 5 Jameses successively occupied the throne. The first was 45 when he was murdered at Perth. He was succeeded by a boy of 7. The second was 30 when he was killed at Roxburgh. He was succeeded by a boy of 8. The third was 35 when he was assassinated at Sorky. He was succeeded by a boy of 16. The fourth died at Flodden, aged 43. He was succeeded by an infant son. The fifth died of a broken heart at Falkland. He was succeeded by his daughter Mary, who was then 8 days old. We cannot wonder that in these circumstances, heavily handicapped as they were, they should have failed to keep the nobles steadily in check. The wonder is that they were able to do what they did. The surest testimony, indeed, that feudalism was on the wane, that the life had died or was dying out of it, is to be found in the fact that the Jameses, in spite of protracted minorities, should have been able, in a manner, to hold their own to the end. 4. The preeminence of the House of Douglas was a real misfortune for the royal house. For more than a generation, it was felt that any day, a disaffected earl, with the northern and border barons at his back, might make a bold bid for the crown. The Stuarts and the Douglases were rival claimants, and the title of the Douglas was thought by many to be the better of the two. The Stuarts derived their title through Elizabeth More, who had been the first wife of Robert II. but her son, who afterwards became Robert III, had been born before the marriage was solemnised. According to the canon law, which recognised the legitimacy of the offspring if the parents were subsequently married, the boy was a true heir. But after Elizabeth More was dead, Robert had married again, and the descendants of his second wife, Euphemia Ross, were not prepared without demur to recognise the law of succession as defined by the ecclesiastical tribunals. But Douglas derived his right through Euphemia Ross, and whenever the conflict became acute, the superior claims of the heirs of Euphemia were obstinately preferred. There can, I suppose, be no doubt that during the reign of James II of Scotland, it was for long an open question which side would win. Had James been worsted, the Earl of Douglas was prepared to claim the crown, and it is certain that, with two-thirds of Scotland behind him, the claim would have been admitted by the Estates. There were obstacles to complete success, serious obstacles, no doubt, but the Stuarts themselves were to blame. I do not underrate their capacity, nor their fitness in many respects for the high place they occupied. There was hardly a member of the family who was not bright, energetic, capable. They were poets, fluent writers and speakers, adventurous soldiers, able administrators. They were resolved from first to last to hold their own, and they had a high conception of the kingly dignity, yet they were not arrogant. Easy of access, affable, quick at jest or repartee, they were ready, with a sort of plebeian audacity, to welcome good or evil fortune. They had little pride of station. They were men and women who laughed with the keenest zest over the humours of the marketplace, and who did not care to don the mask which custom prescribes when a king mixes with a crowd. The engaging address of the Stuarts attained perhaps its finest expression in Mary, but each could exert on occasion the enchantment whereby men are bewitched. This is no more than the truth, yet the Stuart character was itself at fault. Somewhere in the metal there was a flaw. Infirm of temper, they could not bear a protracted strain. Impatient of opposition, they could not play a waiting game. To form a far-reaching design, to mature it in silence, and to cling to it with dogged tenacity, was a line of policy which a Stuart might approve in his heart, but which he rarely followed. They were at once obstinate and facile, never more so than when James IV, in spite of warning and portent, flung away his crown upon the field of Flodden. His granddaughter had many fine qualities of her family, but she had also their fatal defects. She lacked the coolness, the self-control, the patience that become the diplomatist. The quick resentment was often as imprudent as the prompt forgiveness. Her impulsive anger sometimes undid in a day the politic labour of months. Her keen contempt for the pharisaic bearing and spiritual arrogance of the Congregation of Jesus Christ found vent, sooner or later, in rash and scornful words that worked her infinite harm. She really desired to stand well with the English Queen, but her cousin's mean duplicity and blundering craft exhausted her patience, and a biting jest or a mocking laugh did more to exasperate Elizabeth than the Darnley murder or the Bothwell marriage. What has now been said will serve to indicate the view I take. It would be profitless to multiply illustrations. I do not assert that their defects of temper absolutely disabled them for the work of government, but the absence of steady self-command unquestionably accounts in some measure for the ill luck which followed them like a shadow. Their record certainly would have been less tragic had they been less impatient of counsel and control. This then was the character, these the experiences of the family to whom the government of the English people had passed. It cannot be said that the omens were propitious. Apart from any other consideration, the fact that for 300 years they had been engaged in a constant struggle for supremacy had left behind it an inevitable bias. Their aim had been to aggrandise the kingly office, to extend and strengthen the prerogative. That the immunity from criticism of a divinely appointed ruler should have become an article of the Stuart creed need not surprise us. But if this conviction should prove ingrained and ineradicable, what was to happen when they were brought into direct contact with the popular forces which were already at work in England? Nor was it less than a grave public misfortune that the present representative of the family was one who retained few of their finer traits, and in whom their foibles were caricatured. While no king could be less kingly than the sixth James, no king was more persuaded of his divine commission. The Stuart sovereigns, with rare exceptions, had been poor, poor as church mice, as was said, but James was so impecunious that the very shirts he wore were borrowed. After one or two spasmodic outbursts, of which the Raid of Rivon and the Gowrie conspiracy may be reckoned the most audacious, the great nobles were ceasing to be troublesome, but on the other hand, the arrogant bearing of the Calvinistic clergy had become intolerable. The place of a courtly and diplomatic priest of the old religion had been taken by an indiscreet and vehement minister of the new, who had no respect for decent conventions, and who rebuked king and nobles with more zeal than discretion. The English sectaries, who were separating themselves from the Anglican communion, favoured the Presbyterian rule and ritual, whereas to James, who had been preached at and prayed for all his life, the very name of presbyter had become loathsome. The character of a Stuart, who combined a certain native shrewdness with boundless egotism and insatiable vanity, in whom mental irritability was as little under control as physical restlessness, has often been limned. In the collections of Calderwood and others, the testimony of his Scottish contemporaries will be found. The picture they draw almost passes belief. This egregious schoolboy, who occupies his leisure in writing a commentary on the apocalypse, who in public controversy swears like a trooper and scolds like a shrew, the rival theologians being loons and smakes and lean knaves, is surely one of the most singular royal figures of whom any record remains. Long before he went to England, James had fallen under the sway of unworthy favourites. And among these, the Master of Grey, Francis, Earl of Bothwell, the two Campbells, one of whom created Earl of Arran, became Chancellor of the Kingdom, and married the shameless Jezebel of the Calvinistic pulpit, have attained an unenviable notoriety. The successors of Knox were prodigal of invective, neither king nor courtier was spared, and it may be admitted that James's aversion to his spiritual advisers, the Melvilles, the Lawsons, the Blacks, the Gibsons, was not without warrant. It is possible, therefore, that the contemporary narratives, which come to us mainly from ministers of the Kirk, are somewhat highly coloured. Yet, after all, there is substantial agreement that the only Stuart who was a grotesque and undignified pedant should have worn the Scottish crown when the English succession opened was one of those scurvy tricks which fortune is apt to play. With the end of the chapter reached, we'll finish this reading for now, but we will look to carry on with this book in the future. So, thank you for listening, and good night.